I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The city of Orlando spent over $200 million renovating the Citrus Bowl. The 90% overhaul was just about finished as Orlando played host to the Florida Classic last weekend, and city officials hope the upgraded stadium will attract other big events too. I spoke with lead designer and architect on the project, Rick Strawn, about the design elements and challenges of renovating an 80-year-old stadium.
Early on, the city's first challenge to us was to totally just redesign and redefine the image of the stadium so that the average fan would have no idea what they're looking at anymore.
A conversation with Rick Strawn, the lead architect on the Citrus Bowl renovation. But first, Parkinson's disease causes tremors and interferes with walking, talking, and movement. Public figures like Muhammad Ali, Michael J. Fox, and Linda Ronstadt have helped raise the profile in the fight to find a cure for Parkinson's. Speech-language pathologist Samantha Allenderry works to help those with Parkinson's retain and sometimes recover their speaking ability. She joins me to talk about the Parkinson Voice Project's regimen of intense vocal therapy and how it helps patients with more than just communication. Samantha Allenderry talks about the Parkinson Voice Project. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Samantha Allenderry. Samantha is a speech pathologist and she's the CEO of the Parkinson Voice Project. Thanks for coming in, Samantha.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, tell me about the Parkinson Voice Project. What is it and what are you doing with it?
Well, Parkinson Voice Project is the only nonprofit organization in the country solely dedicated to restoring the voices of those with Parkinson's. So we provide voice therapy to any patient with Parkinson's who needs help with their speech and their voice.
Mm-hmm. When you think of Parkinson's, oftentimes you think of well-known people who have it. So, for example, Michael J. Fox.
Yes.
He's probably the most well-known figure at this point, and of course there's Muhammad Ali too.
Yes, Muhammad Ali, Billy Graham, Janet Reno, Linda Ronstadt.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
These are folks, I mean, when you think about what the disease does, do you feel like people are more likely to associate it with the kind of physical tremors than what it does to the voice?
Absolutely. You know, almost 90% of people with Parkinson's report difficulty with their voice. Mm-hmm. Although, yes, people do think of the tremors and the slow movements, difficulty with balance. They also think of the disorder as being a condition of the elderly or older people, although Michael J. Fox has done a lot to bring attention to that it can affect younger people.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest patient we have evaluated was diagnosed at the age of 12, so it can affect different people of different ages.
That's got to be pretty tough getting that diagnosis at the age of 12.
Yes, very much so. We have a board member who had his first symptoms at age 17. He's mm-hmm. now in his 40s. But yeah, very difficult and difficult to diagnose. It took him maybe 6 years to finally get the diagnosis of Parkinson's because, of course, the doctors weren't looking for that at first.
Is that changing? Do they now look for those symptoms younger and maybe associate them with Parkinson's where they might have not before?
I think that they are, and especially with Michael J. Fox coming out, I think that that has brought a lot of attention to it. The sad fact is that the National Parkinson Foundation reports that 50% of people with Parkinson's are being treated by their family doctor. There may not be a movement disorder specialist in their area, and so I think that makes diagnosis a little bit more difficult also. But
having said that, I mean, are family doctors now sort of more aware of what to look for and maybe a little more kind of up to date with how they can go about helping people with Parkinson's?
I would think that they would be, but they're treating so many different disorders. It would be difficult for them to keep up with all the medications. And
sure.
Everyone with Parkinson's looks different and has a different combination of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So not everybody has tremors. Not everybody has the stiffness and rigidity. So that makes it difficult too, I think, for physicians.
So tell me about what happens to somebody who has Parkinson's and things start to happen with their voice. Like, what would be the first thing they would notice vocally?
Mm-hmm. The early symptoms of a voice disorder in Parkinson's are scratchy or hoarse vocal quality. a reduced volume, the person will start speaking softer, and so maybe people will start leaning in or asking them to repeat. And the voice becomes very inconsistent. Our patients say that they can't count on their voice. They never know when they speak what's going to come out. Mm-hmm. Some days it can sound really strong, and other days it's very weak. But those would be the early symptoms.
So your project, how do you go about trying to restore that voice?
At Parkinson Voice Project, we've developed a two-part voice program. So the first part is called Speak Out, and that's intensive one-on-one voice therapy with a speech-language pathologist. And if you were to walk in the halls of Parkinson Voice Project, you would hear a lot of yelling and loud vocal sounds. What we do is we teach people with Parkinson's how to speak with intent, mm-hmm. how to be more purposeful in their speech, to focus and to be mindful. So they work with a speech-language pathologist for 4 weeks, and then they transition to the second part of our program, which is the loud crowd, which consists of weekly voice groups and a singing program.
Singing,
yes. A couple months ago, we actually had a program where we had nearly 100 people with Parkinson's sing for a crowd of 1,000 mm-hmm. people. So that's another way to motivate our patients and encourage them to do their exercises. Parkinson's is unique in terms of speech therapy because since it's a progressive degenerative disorder and it keeps getting worse and worse, people never graduate or finish speech therapy. They have to do it for the rest of their lives, and mm-hmm. that's why we have the loud crowd.
What were they singing in this performance?
Well, it was a 1960s theme, so we were singing the Beach Boys and the Beatles, and it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. How much can you do to help somebody overcome some of these physical symptoms? I mean, as you say, it's not something you graduate from or you're cured from. It kind of gradually gets worse, I guess, but there are obviously some things you can do to help mitigate that. So, you know, how much can you help somebody make sure that they don't completely lose their vocal faculties?
The treatment that we do at Parkinson Voice Project is extremely effective. Patients come in and perhaps they can barely speak. They're speaking maybe even softer than a whisper. And after 4 weeks, they are producing a strong and normal voice. The challenge with Parkinson's is they have to keep up with the exercises. So they have to keep doing it. And that's the hard part. But no, we have people that come in who haven't been able to order their food at a restaurant, who have been struggling at work. But after the Speak Out program, they are producing a louder, clearer, more articulate voice.
Mm-hmm. With the singing side of it, how many of the people who go through the program would have sung before or had some kind of interaction with singing before in their life?
Out of the 100 patients who performed, we maybe had a dozen who could read music and had really sung. Most of them say, no, I was the one who my choir director at school asked me to mouth the words, or
oh, really?
I got to play the triangle while everybody else sang. So, no, they're not, it's new for them.
If you're somebody who has some vocal ability, like, you know, say you're an actor or you're a singer anyway, do you think that would maybe mean that some of these symptoms wouldn't be, you know, visible as soon as they are with somebody who doesn't have any of that training?
Well, I think some of the reports with Linda Ronstadt, where she has described that she can't sing anymore, mm-hmm. I think that might answer it. No, I don't think so. I think it actually might be more difficult for people who are professional singers. Mm-hmm. I have found in treating the Parkinson patients that the professional singers are harder to treat because they've been trained to work on the respiration and the breathing.
Right.
And with Parkinson's, we work on increasing loudness, putting forth more effort. So, for example, one singer is very subtle. You know, he might, in the expression and the way he sings, he wants to be more dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was worried that by putting forth more effort, he would lose that quality of his voice. But it actually gets better with Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm. And is it kind of like, you know, is it mind over matter, or is it sort of like doing stomach crunches for the voice or some kind of, you know, physical workout? What's more important there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of it is mind over matter. Definitely. If people think they can get better, they can. But with Parkinson's, they truly can get better. Mm-hmm. The problem with Parkinson's is that the automatic function of the brain is not working as it used to. So things don't happen automatically. People with Parkinson's have to think about everything that they do, including speaking. But so as they're going through the treatment and they're learning to speak with intent and to use their CEO voice, they're also realizing that they need to walk with intent, write with intent. It's not that people with Parkinson's can't make more normal movements. It's that the automatic part of the brain is not working as it used to. So it's not going to come automatically. They have to think about it.
So what about the other symptoms of Parkinson's? If you work on your speech, does that help combat some of the other symptoms of Parkinson's as well?
Well, the muscles we use for speaking are the same muscles we use for swallowing.
Right.
So over 70% of our patients say that their swallowing has improved with the voice treatment. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it gives people a lot of confidence. When your speech is not clear, it has a dramatic effect on you in your personal life and your professional life. And so when you're able to speak better, you get your confidence better, and you think that, you know, I think I can battle other things too.
You mentioned some folks who are on your board who had this diagnosis pretty early on.
Yes.
In terms of people who go through the program, though, what's the youngest person you've had through there?
I would say the youngest patient we've treated was in their 30s by the time we met them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Are they still part of the program?
Mm-hmm. Yes, patients stay in the program forever. So I started the Loud Crowd in 1999, and I still have some patients who are still in the Loud Crowd who have never had to repeat the first part of the intensive program because they've kept up with their exercises and they come to group, and group helps them to stay accountable, keeps them motivated.
Just explain what actually happens with the Loud Crowd again.
The Loud Crowd is the maintenance part of our program. Mm-hmm. So we have voice groups. Voice groups and singing groups. So we do the voice exercises, but then we also talk about topics of interest for the patients. We have 9 different voice groups that meet every week at Parkinson Voice Project, and they're separated by severity level, how much difficulty they're having with their voice, but also by age, because our patients who are raising teenagers have different life experiences, different needs than, let's say, our great-grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
So it is also a support group.
Mm-hmm. How did you get so interested in this?
I got interested into this. I grew up with a communication disorder. I was born with a cleft palate, went through a lot of speech therapy. And I found that when I realized that people with Parkinson's can speak better when they use intent and put forth more effort, it actually helped my own communication disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's amazing that somebody with a progressive degenerative disorder can get better so quickly. That's the one unique thing about Parkinson's, is that our patients are better in a few days. It really doesn't take much. Once they realize they have more control over the issue than they thought they did, it's amazing to see the results. Very different from somebody, let's say, who has suffered a stroke or a traumatic brain injury where it might take years for them to get better.
Mm-hmm.
People with Parkinson's definitely see dramatic results in just a few days.
Before you started this project, what was the approach? Was it more like a kind of a drug therapy, or were there other kinds of physical therapy that people were doing to try and mitigate some of these symptoms?
Before this, people really didn't think that speech therapy would help. Because we didn't realize, because the mindset was, since it's progressive and degenerative, why treat it? It's just going to get worse. But now we know that's not the problem. The problem is the patients have to keep up with it. And that's why we have the Loud Crowd.
Mm-hmm. And as far as access to it, I mean, what sort of, do you have to do outreach to maybe find some of those harder to reach patients, or maybe patients who aren't as connected in the community don't have the kind of resources that maybe somebody who already is pretty active and takes care of the health might anyway?
Well, we definitely need to do a lot of education in the community, in the country, really. At Parkinson Voice Project, our program is funded entirely through donations in a pay-it-forward system. So we don't bill insurance and we don't charge patients for therapy. So any patient that needs help can come to our clinic to receive it. We're also conducting workshops where we're training speech-language pathologists from around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we've trained over 130 speech-language pathologists, but we will be training more, and we're creating an online training workshop where speech pathologists will not have to travel to Dallas in order to receive the treatment. So hopefully, by training them, more patients will be treated.
Is that something you're thinking of maybe moving into in the future?
Who knows? Maybe we could start a for-profit arm of this nonprofit where we help people speak better in the professional world, and it helps to fund the nonprofit part and help people with Parkinson's.
So how can people find out about this project if they've heard this program and they want to go and find out some more information?
They can go to our website, ParkinsonVoiceProject.org, and there's lots of information on the website.
I've been speaking to Samantha Allendary. She's a speech pathologist. She's also the CEO of the Parkinson Voice Project, which is aimed at giving people who suffer from Parkinson back their voice. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. Archived interviews are available at WMFE.org or on WMFE's smartphone app, which is available for iOS and Android. Coming up after the break, I talk to Citrus Bowl lead designer and architect Rick Strawn. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. The newly renovated Citrus Bowl hosted the Florida Classic football game over the weekend. Last week, I spoke to the lead designer on the renovation, architect Rick Strawn. I'm joined in the studio by Rick Strawn. Rick is the lead designer and architect of the Citrus Bowl reconstruction project. Rick, thank you for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, the ribbon's been cut on this project. There's still a few things to be done, I guess, some final construction to wrap up. But overall, are you happy with the way it turned out?
I'm absolutely delighted. And there is a lot of work to be done. The Turner will be on site through the month of April of 2015. I was happy to see, it looks like the stadium's nowhere near done. I was happy to see that most of the work that still needs to be ongoing is just cleanup.
From the outside, I mean, you would have, I guess, toured around the stadium before work started on it. How different does it look now?
That's a very key question, because early on, the city's first challenge to us was to totally just redesign and redefine the image of the stadium, so the average fan would have no idea what they're looking at anymore. So we transformed that image in a very dynamic way, if you will. The previous Citrus Bowl, if you remember, had four very iconic ramp towers in each corner, mm-hmm. with large circles in the vertical circulation towers. We felt that it was necessary to remove those four elements as step one in transforming the image. And then we're left with, of course, the problem of how do we get people up in the building. So what we did was we created steel frames on the east and west sides, very open and airy and colorful and Floridian. And within those frames are contained the new vertical circulation elements, which include stairs, elevators, and escalators.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself became the new elevation to the building, and we add splashes of color to that as well to give it a playful Floridian, you know, citrus colors, to give it that playful sort of open and airy and cheerful Floridian look.
When you're designing something like a stadium that's so big and it has a really specific purpose, is it difficult to kind of go crazy with the creative side of it? Because in some ways it seems like you're a little bit restricted because of the fact that you're designing a building which just has, you know, one function, and that's kind of what it's going to have to look like.
Well, the real challenge was we had to leave the upper decks. My firm did the upper decks in 1989, and that was a design challenge to keep those and come up with a new image around them. Hopefully the fans won't look and say, oh, look, there's the old stadium. But we created a completely new stadium exclusive of those upper decks, but I think we've disguised them. We actually made improvements to them both structurally and cosmetically, so they look better as well. There was actually a lot we could do. We had a charrette with the mayor and his staff, Mayor Dyer and his staff, in Kansas City a couple years ago, and we sort of painted the vision for that. The city actually did, and we came up. He asked us to think outside the box, and by the time the charrette was over, he said, well, I'm not sure I wanted you to think that far outside the box. So we actually came up with a lot of creative ideas. The one you see was the most affordable and the most transforming.
This stadium won't only be used for sports. I mean, that's the primary purpose, but there might be a concert or two.
No,
there.
It's a multi-use venue that's used. It will be used for concerts. It'll be used for Monster Jam. The city has, you know, they challenged us to use it for to make it available to any number of uses. You know, the I believe Orlando City Soccer will still finish.
They've got the upcoming season.
So we had to design it to accommodate soccer, football, Monster Jam, you know, any number of non-sport events too. Mm-hmm.
Is that tricky, trying to come up with something that fits all sizes?
Well, what that does is it moves the field wall out to a bigger size and further restricts, you know, the number of rows we're able to get before we run into that upper deck. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And what about acoustics? If you're holding a concert in a venue like that, is there much you can do to make sure that people get a good sound from a concert?
That's a commonly asked question. And honestly, the concert, the people who run the concert come in and test the acoustics and set up the speaker arrangements and adjust the sound. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not acoustical engineers by any stretch of the imagination. We used a firm to do the sound and video boards for this who are... They're good at it. I don't know if they design concerts per se, but the people who come in and run the concerts pretty much take care of that.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of relying on the amplification and everything rather than the sort of natural amphitheater of the stadium.
Yes, sir.
What about the history? Because obviously the stadium's on a site that goes back some ways, 1936, I believe.
That's correct.
Is that something you had to sort of think pretty hard about when you were coming up with the design for it and being sensitive to the history of the stadium?
The history of the stadium is fascinating to me and to a lot of people. You mentioned 1936. It was a WPA project signed into fruition by President Roosevelt. So it was actually built as a high school football stadium with, mm-hmm. with two poured-in-place concrete bleachers on either side that lasted forever. You know, their tread depth might have even been worse. Very fan unfriendly, poured mm-hmm. concrete. And it's funny, when they had to tear the stadium down, everything came down in a heartbeat except those poured in place concrete pieces. But they came down fast enough. I don't know if you've seen the fast motion replay on the Turner's webcam. It's just really interesting. If you haven't seen it, you should go look at it. You can watch the whole stadium be demolished and rebuilt in 1 minute and 6 seconds, I believe.
Mm-hmm. What's the lifespan of a stadium like this?
Well, that's a good question. Concrete, obviously longer than steel. Your old stadium was, you know, the rusted steel. I would hope 50 or 60 years. Mm-hmm. That's a typical, like, concrete life of a building. If you take good care of it, if you maintain it. This is precast concrete. If you maintain the joints and wash it down and replace the joint, you know, you can make it last pretty much as long as you want.
But what about considerations like making your stadium resilient to natural disasters?
The big trick here is wind load, from hurricanes, and I'm not a structural engineer, but we had the best structural engineers you can find in this part of the country do the stadium, so mm-hmm. we feel really good about it. In case anyone's worrying about sitting in or using the stadium, they don't need to be.
Right. And just sort of back to the history, there was an old baseball field, Tinker Field, nearby. Is that something you kind of thought about when you were figuring out how to make this rebuild?
We thought about Tinker Field. Honestly, it's reared its head. I love Tinker Field. You know, I love history and baseball. And we've talked to so many people about it. And honestly, at this moment in time, I don't know where it stands, if it's going to become a park, if they're going to keep it or what. They held events on Tinker Field. They had Electric Daisy recently, mm-hmm. and other events. You know, they have before the bowl games, they have pregame events, like a corporation will set up hospitality tents on Tinker Field. So they use it. The historical part of Tinker Field, I've been told all along, is the field itself, not necessarily the stadium. So, but we need to see how that plays out before I can really comment on it.
Mm-hmm. Tapping into that nostalgia is obviously important, but at what point do you think people have to say, okay, this field has outlived its life, we need to move on?
Oh, many people have said that. Mm-hmm. I mean, many people have said that, but then they meet resistance from people who appreciate the history of this facility too. So it's going to have to be, there's going to have to be some discussion.
And as far as this stadium, other stadiums go, what about sort of fitting into the surrounding landscape? I mean, how important is that?
It's critical. The project designer is an individual named Fernando Vasquez. He had never seen, I've seen this facility for the last 11 years trying to get it off the ground. We brought in Fernando. He's a super creative guy. He came, and his first impression of the stadium was something I had never heard before. He said, this stadium sits in a garden. Now, someone from Orlando may say, come on, it's Paramore. It's not a garden. Well, compared to the stadiums we do all across the country, it doesn't sit in a sea of asphalt parking. It doesn't sit downtown adjacent to high-rise buildings. It sits in on a site that's grass, trees, water on two sides. You know, that's really a garden. And Fernando wanted very desperately to keep that feel and bring that inside, that outside garden inside. And I know the city's also, you know, sort of pretty enamored with the whole part about making this a Florida venue. Mm-hmm. So we've actually brought part of the outside in and part of the inside out, and it's that open, airy Floridian feeling.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of construction going on in Orlando right now. You mentioned the soccer team. They're getting a new stadium.
Right.
They'll break ground on that pretty soon, so mm-hmm. if they haven't already. But I get the feeling the city's going to look quite different, you know, say 5-10 years from now. What do you think about the sort of new development going on? Are you going to be back with some more projects of your own?
We would love to be. I think the city's happy with the job we've done to date. We're not doing the soccer stadium, of course, mm-hmm. as you probably know, but I'm just delighted to see development along Church Street, because that is a really cool corridor, and they're going to bring it to life with other projects as well. And it's, you know, kudos to the city, to the mayor, to the people, to the developers of that. I think it's just wonderful for this city.
Mm-hmm. There seems, and this is probably something that's, you know, it's not just limited to Florida or Orlando, but oftentimes it's kind of like a donut effect. Like, you get little pockets of conurbation sort of outside the city center, and the city center can sometimes go a bit flat. I think Church Street, that's sort of happened in that area for some time. Used to be a lot more going on, and do you see that kind of coming back, that sort of inner city core?
I would love to tell you. I'm not from Orlando, so I'm really not able to speak to that. Church, just from an outsider's point of view, Church Street seems like a logical area for development, mm-hmm. for the city, for entertainment. It's, you know, I love Church Street myself, and I hope someday I can come back in my old age and walk down all the way down Church Street and just say, wow, look at all the development here that we sort of started with the renovation or the reconstruction of the Citrus Bowl football stadium. Actually, the Amway Center started it. By, mm-hmm. They're an anchor at one end, and we're an anchor at the other end, and we anticipate development between the two.
I've been speaking to Rick Strawn. He's the lead designer and architect of the Citrus Bowl reconstruction project. Rick, thank you very much for speaking to me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.